Hello, this presentation of ACABA was created by Milestones Autism Organization, a nonprofit organization dedicated to train parents and professionals of best practice approaches to working with children with on the autism spectrum. If you'd like to find out more information about Milestones or find autism resources, go to www.milestones.org. My name is Kirsten Johnson, and my information is always on the website www.milestones.org. We now are on part two of Basic ABA. We will be discussing how to get started and choose your target goals. We will also be talking about what is a discrete trial. Okay, so before we start talking about the basic principles of ABA, I want to talk a little bit about what you would need to do to get started on teaching your child different skills, whether a child or an adult. And first thing you do is you need to focus on some target goals. I know there's lots and lots of different things you'd like to teach your child, such as sitting at a table for longer than 2 minutes, or getting them to turn off the TV without being reminded more independently, or be able to get homework done more independently. But sometimes we focus on too many, and it's just not very realistic that we really should only focus on maybe about 3 different goals. Now, it's different if you have a home program, then that's different because it's a very structured program. But as a parent with all the other things that you have going on, you do not want to try to focus on too many things at the same time. In fact, if this is your first time at trying to use these techniques in your home, you just try to focus on just one. Try something that's not too difficult and actually maybe something your child enjoys to do so that you can just practice using these types of techniques. Then I would keep a running list of skills in a notebook and maybe put them in hierarchy of the most important to least important, ones that may take a longer period of time to teach, such as maybe teaching them to ride a bike and things that might be a little bit simpler, like being able to put their shoes in a bin when they get home. I also find that families that seem to have less stress and seem to be happier tend to pick skills that really have a social significance to their family. So if their family loves to ski or rollerblade or swim, then they try to always be working on those skills with their child. Also try to find what your child has an interest in and try to also build on those skills. I know a child who had passion for water, loved playing in the water as a child, and the parents continued the interest, and the child became a very good swimmer and at some point was on a swim team. Some of the things you need to also think about when you decide what you'd like to work on with your children is the time element. How long may it take? Are we going on vacation soon? Is the school schedule going to change? So if it's something that you think may take longer, then you may want to make sure you don't do it when there's going to be some interruptions, like you might be having a grandparent or relative staying or a holiday's coming up. Because when you do want to focus on a skill, you want to be able to have enough time to practice it over and over again. Children on the spectrum need a lot of repetition when learning a skill. And even after they have mastered that skill, they need to be able to continue using it in their lives in order for it to not be lost. Then you need to find out what are the prerequisites to the skills and how can we break it down to make it teachable. And so you can't maybe teach how to ski if your child already doesn't like to have lots of clothes on, like coats and hats and gloves. You may have to work on that first. They may not like to have something on their feet. They may need to understand right and left. And so you need to focus on what are the prerequisites we need before we actually teach the skill of skiing. Catherine Reese's book also does, as I had stated in part one, an excellent prerequisite outline in the front. And it does actually get to more sophisticated academic skills. So it is for intermediate students also. And, you know, if you do have some other questions about that, I'm sure if you spoke with your teachers at school, that they would probably be help you also of what some prerequisites would be. One of the first basic skills your child should know how to do is imitation. And so if you ask your child, do this, and you touch your nose, the child would do it. So you can't say, touch your nose and do it, but say, do this and touch your nose, and then they follow your lead. I'll be talking more about that in part 3. Okay, wow. Well, we're in 5 minutes in, so let's go for our first ASR question for this part. The question is, how do you choose what to work on? A, call your psychic. B, pick 4 or 5 things your child dislikes to do. Or C, find skills that will have a social significance to his or her life. I believe the answer is C. And I want to stress again, if this is the first time working with your child, please pick something that your child is going to enjoy or is not very difficult, because you want to have an opportunity to practice these new techniques, and you want to be able to have your child feel successful. Okay, so some of the tools and techniques we're going to be discussing are discrete trials, motivation and reinforcement, prompting, shaping, task analysis and chaining, pairing, and using observations or taking data. So when can you use ABA? It should not be reserved for structured teaching sessions. I know that many people think of ABA as just using it in the discrete trial training, which means sitting a one-on-one with a teacher and a child, or a parent and a child, or a tutor and a child, and doing, you know, 10 questions and then reinforcing them throughout that session. But it should not be reserved for that, because what will happen then is that child only knows how to do it in that setting. It needs to be generalized so it can be used in a natural environment. Again, the natural environment means to teach it in the place that child would normally do that skill. So if you're teaching them how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you do it in the kitchen. Or how to make a snack, you would do it in the kitchen, or brush your teeth in the bathroom, and so on and so forth. Now, sometimes it is important to work on a skill in an area that is not distracting, that's cleaned out of maybe some toys in the general area, and the sound is quiet. Because even for adults and for typical developing children, it is difficult to work in an environment that's very cluttered. But it's not necessary that you have to do that when you're teaching a new skill. And if you do teach a skill in a very structured environment, then you need to, as soon as possible, start generalizing that skill or using it in other areas that are more appropriate, so that the child isn't only doing it in the isolated area. Lots of times when I've worked with families for programs, I've been put in the basement because it's the least distractible area. But then what my fear is then the child only does it in the basement with that tutor. So I try, as soon as the child understands a color or a certain phrase that they're using, I tell the parents, you need to use this. You need to use it everywhere you go. And so that they're used to doing it with other people in other places. Okay, it's time for another ASR question. When should you use ABA? A, only in a structured environment. B, after getting a fresh bag of M&Ms. C, as often as you can in the natural environment. I believe the correct answer is C, as often as you can in a natural environment. That does not mean that sometimes when you're trying to focus on a particular skill that you shouldn't do it in a structured environment, at a table or on a floor that's cleared of distractions, in order to make sure you have your child's attending to be able to focus on exactly what you're trying to teach them. But then once they understand the color red or the numbers, the answers to the flashcards, you want to start doing it in different places with different people. And that is called generalizing. I want to talk a little bit about attending, because in order to teach your child, you have to make sure that they are attending to what you're saying and your directions. Now, some parents can just tell if their child's attending by the way they're standing. Eye contact, we don't give as much eye contact as sometimes we expect of these children that are on the autism spectrum. And you would feel uncomfortable if someone was staring you at the whole time. So really, we usually request fleeting eye contact in order to show that they're attending. You can teach this by giving them a purpose to give you eye contact in the first place. Many children, when we learn to have eye contact when we're babies, it's to communicate. And they really don't use their eye contact. I mean, when I say that, some children do, but they don't normally use their eye contact to communicate when they're younger. And they have no purpose. They're not looking at our faces to find out what it is, how we're feeling, and to get cues. So one way you can help increase eye contact is by maybe having them jump on a trampoline or doing something that they enjoy to do and then stopping it and waiting to see if you get some fleeting eye contact. And as soon as you get just a glimpse, then say, oh, let's jump, and then have them keep jumping. Or if they're playing on something and you turn it off, and then they're going to look and see why you turned it off, and then you'll say, oh, turn on, and then you're turning it back on. Okay, and then this is giving them a purpose to use eye contact as a way of communication. Another way to encourage it is definitely through reinforcement, which we'll talk a lot more about in the next part. Then there is responding to their name by using eye contact. And some different ways you can do this is either have a desired object and say their name, Joshua, and then put that desired object in their line of vision. And then and when they're looking at it, bringing it up to your face. And then say, nice looking, and then giving them the desired object. And then you would do this over and over again, making sure that there's not too much time between each one to try to increase the amount of times that they're looking at you. Now, you want to start pausing after the first two times to give them an opportunity to look without seeing the desired object. But if they don't look immediately, then go and put it in their line of vision again. So then by the third time that you've called their name, Joshua, then you might count 1, 2, 3, pause to see. If they don't look, then bringing it back up in their line of vision and bringing it back up to your face. But by the third or fourth time, you should start seeing that they will no longer have to use that object in order to get them to look at you. If they are not increasing they're responding to their name, then you may want to look at your reinforcer or your time, see if you're not doing it quick enough or you're spending too much time between each time you say their name, that they're forgetting what the response is that you're asking. You can't force a child to give you eye contact. So the best you can do is find things that are very reinforcing for them to look at. And then when they say their name, put that very reinforcing thing in their line of vision and bringing it up to your face. You could also do this with an activity such as blowing bubbles, where you'd be blowing bubbles, you would stop, say their name, Joshua, and then put the bubbles in their line of vision and then bringing it up to their face. And then make sure you praise them, saying, nice looking, and then continue blowing bubbles. Just remember that unless your child is attending, they will not be able to learn. So if they are distracted by other things, you need to address those first. Sometimes if you do something very simple with them, if they seem to be distracted with a stim or something that's going on in the room, if you do something very fun with them that they enjoy doing that can distract them a little bit, and then jump right into the thing that you want to work on with them. So let's say that they already know imitation and you're sitting there and trying to work on them pointing to things in a book, and you notice they're becoming very stimulated to something in the room, or maybe they start grinding their teeth. And then you might stop what you're doing and say, let's do this, and then wiggle your fingers. And then maybe do something silly. Do this, then stick out your tongue. Or do this and have them chomp their teeth up and down, especially if they're doing something with their mouth right now. Maybe do this and do some jumping up and down, maybe some physical motion if they happen to be physically stimming. And then as soon as you kind of see them getting into it, then just jump right in and say, okay, let's find the dog in the book. And then try to move quickly into, it's like building a momentum of trying to get the child back into attending to what you're doing. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about discrete trial. It can become very confusing. So if you don't understand it, I understand. You can always email me questions. But there are three components to a discrete trial. We have hundreds of them every day with our children. And what it is you actually have a discriminative stimulus. And the discriminative stimulus signals to the child that there is a specific response that you want. It can be a verbal direction, or it could be a nonverbal item that's in front of them that tells them there's a response that's needed from you. A stop sign would be a discriminative stimulus because it signals a response from us to stop. Okay, the second part is a response. And the response is going to be correct, maybe partially correct, incorrect, or they may not respond at all. And then the third part is the consequence. And so when the child responded, were you able to give a reinforcement or correction, or did you do nothing at all? Understanding a discrete trial is very important because in order to change the response, you have to make sure you have the appropriate discriminative stimulus and the appropriate response. You need to make sure that the discriminative stimulus or the SD at the beginning of the discrete trial, it's short, it's a concise, and that you have a clear expectation of your target response. Like I said, it can be verbal, such as where's the ball, let's color, do you want another one? Or it can be nonverbal, which is communication, temptations, or something like standing in front of them while they're watching TV because you're requesting them to ask you to move, okay, which is something you can do with older children. I think one of our problems as parents is that we just talk too much when we give directions. Sometimes when I ask my kids to do things, I will tell them, okay, it's time to get ready for school. Everyone get your backpack, because remember yesterday you forgot your backpack, and, you know, did you, Joe, remember to put your notebook in there from yesterday? So now I've done this little commentary while they're after my request to where they've forgotten what it is that I've actually asked them to do. And so try not to talk too much. Try to give what is it that you want them to do and then follow through on it. And you also know that if you say the same instruction over and over and over again without following through, the child gets to know that, oh, well, I've got three more times before they're really going to have me do it. And at first, you may want to just use the same type of direction and not change the wording too much, because that can become very confusing. And then as the child becomes better, then you definitely want to change what the SD is for the same response, so that they don't become very robotic and only be able to respond if the person asking request doesn't say it exactly the same way. So instead of saying, point to the ball, you might say, give me the ball, or touch the ball, or hand me the ball, so that they know different SDs for the same response. Okay, then the second part of the discrete trial is the child's response. So you're going to have a correct response, partially correct response, an incorrect response, or no response at all. The one that you do not want to see often is the incorrect response. An example I like to give is professional athletes say that when they want to do well in a game, that they think about the perfect shot in their head over and over and over again, them throwing the ball perfectly and it going in the hole, throwing the ball perfectly and it going in the hole. Okay. And so I try to think of the same thing with children on the spectrum, that if you want to teach them something, you want them to practice in their head the right way each time. Even if you're helping them physically or giving them the answer, you want them to have success. And then that way, when it gets to be where they're doing things more independently, you're giving them an opportunity that they're going to be successful because they've been practicing it. So please don't let your child practice the incorrect response multiple times. And this goes for older children too. If they're learning their multiplication facts, it's much better to teach them the correct answer by helping them over and over again than allowing them to keep guessing the wrong answer and then saying, no, that's not right, let's try it again, because they're still practicing the incorrect response. The last part of the discrete trial then is the reinforcement or the correction. So this we'll talk a little bit more in part 3 of what that is. But so the whole complete discrete trial would be, as an example, number one, the discriminative stimulus, which could be a direction, do you want a cookie? And then the second step would be the child's response, which could be the child saying yes, or maybe reaching for it. And then the third part of the discrete trial would be the reinforcement and correction, which possibly could be you give them the cookie, which would be a reinforcement. Or if they hadn't said anything, then we would do a correction at that point. Another example would be the first step, the discriminative stimulus, would be that they have gone to their schedule and see a picture of a child playing basketball. And this would signal them for step 2, which would be the response would be to for them to go and do basketball practice. And then the step 3 would be reinforcing them for following that direction, whether it is that they get a break or maybe there's a picture of another activity they get to do. I hope you can see how we use this format throughout our day, whether it's with our children or with our spouse or another person that we may work with. Okay, so I have 2 final ASR questions and then we'll be done for this section. What is a discrete trial? Is it A, a direction or signal, response and consequence? B, when you sit at a table with your child and show him or her flashcards? Or C, when you can't talk about a specific court case? Okay, so the answer is A. Do not forget that the SD could be verbal or nonverbal. The last question is, why don't you want your child to repeat an incorrect response? A, he or she won't make a 3-point shot in the future. B, you want him to have more opportunities to practice the correct response. Or C, you won't be able to give him a reinforcement. And the answer is B. Please remember that you don't want to practice an incorrect response with your child. It is better to help them get the correct response and be successful than allow them to practice the incorrect one. All right, so part 3 will be about reinforcement. Please feel free to email me if you have any questions about discrete trials or the different things I talked about in part 2.